I'm Dr. Rod Berger. Sit back, grab a cup of coffee, and explore some of today's most pressing educational issues through the experienced eyes of leading education personalities. Welcome to Coffeed. Well, John, let's sort of turn the tables on another area of expertise, and one often that is marginalized in the popular press. And then, you know, we see things sort of, you know, ping the meter because it's going to get eyeballs on websites, and we're going to have people asking lots of questions. Yeah. And that has to, John, that has to do with autism, right? And so we've seen, you know, Time Magazine had an article recently that I know you had some commentary on, and they were asking if all babies should be screened for autism. And what I thought was really interesting from your part, maybe I just caught you in a good moment, John, is when you were saying, shouldn't we just then screen infants for Alzheimer's? And I just love your initial take as we just sit here and talk about it.
Oh, gosh. You know, screening a neonate for autism, you might as well be screening for Alzheimer's. Autism is not a... it's not proven in the laboratory. It's not diagnosed through a blood test or urinalysis or a brain scan at infancy. It just isn't. Even today, when children are diagnosed, it's a clinical diagnosis. It's a behaviorally based diagnosis on how the children are doing. But let me back up before we get to that. The characteristics that allow a physician, a developmental pediatrician, or a psychologist to diagnose autism aren't apparent until the child has some age on them, perhaps as early as 18 months, maybe a couple of months earlier in some children, but 18 months to 24 months is a window. By the time children are two and they're demonstrating some what we would call standard developmental milestones or standard behavior in speech and in interaction, then we can have a fairly reliable clinical diagnosis of autism. Prior to that 18-month window for most kids, and 24, really for 18 for some, 24 for most, it's pretty speculative. I know that parents would like to know in utero, if they could, if the child had autism. But right now, we don't have any type of technology or clinical capacity or chromosomal analysis or embryonic fluid to say, hey, your baby's at high risk for autism due to this clinical factor. The science may lend itself to that in decades ahead, but the reading that I do and the people with whom I interact in the field, we're not close to that. We're not close to that for families in childbearing years right now. Maybe their children will be, you know, maybe their children will be, or their grandchildren will be able to be beneficiaries of that type of technology.
Why do you think, John,
it just doesn't exist?
Sorry, John, why do you think there's such a, to be a mystery around autism, at least with regards to parents being connected to the professionals that provide services and diagnose from the medical field? Is there a gap in education about what it is? I know people will talk about, obviously, the diagnoses and the processes have gotten maybe better, and so that's where we've seen the uptick, but it always seems that there's this mystery from the parent side on to this point about this article about, you know, how and when we diagnose, you know, what's the impact for services? Where do you think that chasm comes from? And are we getting any closer to sort of bridging that gap so that people feel like they all, on all sides, have the information that they need?
Well, the chasm is kind of multi-pronged in my view. One is there's a chasm of information, and right now there are very good, we're still encouraging physicians and pediatricians and developmental pediatricians and to understand and look for the signs of autism. And we're making good progress. I mean, pediatricians are there to help children. They want to learn. They want to learn the latest science. They want to learn the latest diagnostic characteristics so that they can help families. There's nothing, no harm, no foul in their practice. It's just people have been practicing longer, much longer than this knowledge has been available for them to apply. So there is a process of educating primary care physicians and others that nurse practitioners and others that do a lot of screening of well baby and well baby practices that, you know, are kind of still being schooled up on this. Secondly, and on the good side of that, Rod, is the fact that understanding what to look for, because autism is diagnosed clinically, is kind of cost-free. If parents are taking their children in for well baby checkups, just adding this to a physician's routine or a pediatric nurse practitioner's routine analysis or interaction with mom on does he smile, does he recognize his name, and when they're checking things about developmental and hearing responses that they're looking for, this is another screen technique. Does he like you to hold him? Does he cuddle well? Now that could be a characteristic. It could be a warning sign for some children with autism. So those things are, so there's this kind of one prong, Rod, that says, hey, there's this challenge we have in our society of distributing and disseminating knowledge. We're pretty good at it. We're much better today than we were 30 years ago. But still, there's a practical aspect of adhering to it and beginning to apply it in a clinical setting. The other thing is autism takes many, many forms.
That's the old expression. Every child is different.
Well, you know, the expression in the autism communities is if you've met one child with autism, you've met one child with autism. It is. The spectrum is wide. The spectrum is wider now that the DSM-5 reclassified it a couple of years ago now to change some of the labelings. It's a little deeper and more sensitive to some of the behavioral manifestations of autism, but it's also wider in the things that it captures diagnoses that would have fallen in other classifications in DSM-4. So that's tough. I mean, most scientists and physicians and psychologists and academics are kind of accepting and understand how DSM, the role of what the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual does in our need to classify illnesses in our society. It's some object to the fact that we classify it all, particularly autism and how we classify it. But I think the vast majority of physicians and scientists and academics say, okay, we've got to do it. It's not perfect. And DSM-6 will adjust some of the things that we live with in DSM-5 that we're not happy with. That's the process of improvement.
Now, tell me about the research that you're doing, John. You're working on another book, are you not?
Yeah, Rod. I'd say about 60% of the way. I'm behind on my own personal calendar on it. A book that I hope would have been out about this time, about April of 2016, will probably be out about December of 2016. But when Mark Claypool and I wrote, we're in this together, public-private partnerships in at-risk and special education. We wrote a fifth chapter that really dealt with autism, and by no means was our chapter a superficial treatment of the subject matter per the way the book was organized for our purpose in illustrating public-private partnerships. But it really begged the question to really dive into the subject matter much more deeply. And so we're engaged in a book right now that really examines several aspects of autism. One is it's the way in which it has just exploded in the census and in the identification of the children, and exploded as a kind of a front page story, if you will. Autism has always been in our community and in our societies and in humans, but now it's often front page news. We even have a kind of a lighted up blue campaign that everyone recognizes around the country, or many people recognize it, much like people recognize, associate the color pink now with the Race for Cure and Susan G. Komen and breast cancer. And why NFL players put on pink shoes once a year to acknowledge that. Lighted up blue is that same type of social media and cultural part of our society now in the past 10 years to make us all more aware of autism. So we're looking at those social aspects of how autism has not just come in as a more frequent diagnosis, but as a society, how it has taken more front page news than many other disabilities that affect many, many more school children. There's a kind of it's an interesting story there that we're telling. And then the backside of this, or not really the backside, the interwoven through this, Rod, is how it affects public education, special ed, and how the structures of special education are really getting pushed and challenged to do the very best work they can with children with autism, and the implications and the structural and research pressures that special ed feels about from the rise of autism as a social pressure and phenomenon in our society are also trickling down. That's really not the right word, but ricocheting. They're also going right into other disabilities communities, so that we're seeing disabilities that we're quite familiar with in public education, like learning disabilities or dyslexia, that really came up in vast numbers in the late 70s through the 1980s. We're seeing that those associations are kind of taking a page out of autism's book about how to get the very best treatments that are now being kind of mandated and forced through legislation. Now we see where 43 states, Rod, have a legislation around autism that primarily mandate that health insurance provide coverage for autism. Now we have 20-something states, I'm not sure of the exact number, but it's in the 20s, of dyslexia legislation passed primarily by a group called Decoding Dyslexia. They're really legislative advocates for making sure that dyslexia is treated. And yet you think, well, don't we have IDEA and special education law and rule that guides that? You know, a lot of mainstream public educators feel we do. But the advocates for that disability group feel that they are not enforced, that there's no consequences to failing to enforce them at the public school level. So they are driving law down at the state level that has a much more stringent application and more consequences for failure to abide by the law.
What's the implication?
So, it's fascinating.
What's the implication of these different disabilities in these group, these advocate groups that are going out and saying, okay, well, fine, if you're not going to basically pay attention to us as a whole, we will just talk about and advocate for our own group. Is there any disadvantage to that in the long run, or is this more of an indictment on IDEA and the way that we're looking at it from the federal side?
A huge question. It's a huge question, Rod, and I like every aspect of it. To chat about it. It says a lot of things on a lot of fronts. One is that there's a politicalization of disabilities. That you know, the legislators who I've chatted with say, well, gosh, we passed an autism law. Now we're being asked to pass a dyslexia law. What's next? Are we going to need to pass specific legislation for every disability that is dealt with under IDEA? Well, that's a possibility. That seems to be a growing trend. It says a lot about the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, that it was formed really and truly, Rod, in 1975, and it wasn't born out of thin air. It came through decades of work and legislation prior to it, and advocacy by groups for the differently abled or for the handicapped. And in 75, when it was signed by Gerald Ford, and in 77, when it was fully implemented in public schools, or the implementation began, I should say, in public schools, the law was originally written for severely handicapped children. And the hearings that Congress had and the studies that they did indicated that the early 1970s, there were over 1 million school-aged children that were just denied a public education, just were not allowed to attend, that lived in the attics or lived in the basements of families' homes. Horrible situations that they were never, you know. So that the law was intended for that. And about 2 million severely handicapped children were admitted to public schools, but had a very substandard education, a very substandard development or trajectory for their lives through the process, through what they were receiving. So that law, 94-142, was really targeted for those 3 million people, those 3 million students. And what happened in the history of this law is but in the late 90s, early 80s, we had the phenomenon of learning disabilities and ADHD, attention deficit disorder, hyperactivity diagnosis became very prominent. And so, boy, by 1990, we probably had 6 million children in special education, 3 million those that were the original intent of the law, and 3 million that were already in public school but not receiving what their families and their advocacy organizations felt they needed in order to really fully develop educationally. And that's one thing that IDEA is kind of was a surprise. It was a eureka, and it's a lot of pressure on IDEA. Of 6.5 million of America's 50 million public school children, 13% have an IEP, and of our $600 billion education budget, about $100 billion goes to the special education programs, the largest subsector of the public school financial pie. The pressures are enormous. They also reflect right now our society is one of my philosophies. They reflect our focus on on the individual, that every individual needs to be maximized, that the cause and the need of every individual is the most important thing. It's almost a pathology of individualism in our society right now, rather than other societies that focus on greater common good, good of the community. Not to ignore the individuals through children with handicaps, but our whole society has got almost a pathological individualism about it. That's a personal philosophy of mine, not what I would say a stated science or an empirically investigated piece. The other thing that it says, Rod, is that the era of advocacy organizations being polite and kind of smiling while they advocate for and being patient while they advocate for their groups is coming to an end. The advocacy that is in your face, advocacy that is aggressive, advocacy that is disproportionate, is advocacy that gets results now.
And you argue, could the cynics say that it's also wherever the money is, so the group with potentially the most money is going to get their voice heard, or is that too cynical on my part?
No, it's tied to money, Rod. It's tied to money at the back end and at the front end. And it's tied to money in the advocacy group. The advocacy group with the most money, the most sophistication, the best organization, the greatest use of technologies, the greatest use of social media are the groups that move the needle. It doesn't matter that they represent the largest group of children with handicap or the smallest group of children with handicaps. It is about that type of sophistication in our era of social media and our area of politicalization of handicaps. On the other end, it's really about, on the back end, it's about the structures of finance. What groups, what handicaps get money behind them to improve the situation of the children with a handicapping condition. And that's, again, where autism has broken the mold by getting 43 states to say, hey, this is an issue that deserves health insurance. Now, many health insurance plans exclusively denied in writing treatment of autism. That needed to fall away with federal law. That needed to fall away with mental health acts that said, well, you've got depression. You've got 28 days to get better in the hospital. And that's it, buddy. That's the old model of health insurance. Things of a mental nature had a very, very severe restriction on them. That was unfair, patently and blatantly unfair to adults and children with mental illnesses. They don't necessarily get well in 28 days. They may get well. Some may never get well, but the people deserve the treatment and the health care that can maximize the goodness of their life. Whether it can cure it, I don't know. But they can benefit from longer treatment. They should have longer treatment.
John,
so that is a change in our society.
Yeah, the change in
I'm sorry, Rod. Go ahead.
You know, I was going to say with that point, I mean, you know, as we sort of wrap up our time today, is thinking about, you know, the reauthorization of IDEA. I mean, how do you see that and what do you think is going to be the result? Any news making that's going to come from that, or is it going to stay the status quo?
Well, Rod, I don't know how it can stay the status quo. But the changes, there are, I'm hearing from smart, studied people, advocates, academicians, scholars that study this, attorneys who fight the special education court cases, that several things. One is the children who have reading disabilities gained protection under IDEA through in the 70s and 80s, and they make up, as I said, over half of the kids. That reading and other types of learning disabilities make up a good proportion of the kids in the special education realm. I've heard a couple of people think maybe there'll be a two-class system in the as IDEA is rewritten, that there is a treatment and a process for kind of kids on the shallower end of the special education pool, and then a different class for students who are on the more severe end of the special education pool. That's a new idea to me, to think about that coming out in the reauthorization. I've also heard very clearly that we know what to do in the best interest of children who can't read, who have dyslexia, or have struggles reading, I should say, that can't read. And we know what to do with children on the autism spectrum in terms of processes. But public education is not mandated to do those things. When the laws were written in the 70s and adjusted through the 80s, 90s, and up to 2004, we didn't have the science that we have now on autism, on dyslexia. Now the science is much clearer, the empirical investigations much stronger to say this will teach children with learning disabilities to read better. Yet we don't have any law that says that needs to be the curriculum in the school. The teachers need to be trained in those methodologies. Instead, we send the children into an IEP process in a special education arena that does not train teachers in best practices and does not have a method of constantly upgrading and putting people in who know those practices and making the availability of the best science available to kids. Now, I'm certainly hearing the advocates say, we know what to do. We need laws that make it that enforce its involvement in schools. That is possible, but it would take a long time to implement. They couldn't change it in 2018 at the reauthorization. Maybe if it's reauthorized in 2018, it would take quite some years to get it in place. And the science will continue to evolve.
Yeah.
The problem right now is really the disconnect between special education classrooms and best practice in science. We know, and that's why parents are frustrated with American special education and saying, we can't make it better. Let's just go to the legislative arena and mandate new laws that give our kids the best shot at better lives and circumvent special education. Rod, it's a complex, complex phenomenon we're going there in an era of great advances in techniques and knowledge and science that we have, but getting it back and driving it down to Lincoln Elementary School in Cornwall, Nebraska is really, really an organizational challenge.
Yeah, yeah, time will tell, and definitely nothing that we can solve over one cup of coffee. Well, I've enjoyed it, John. Thanks so much.
Rod, it's always a pleasure. Thank you. I look forward to seeing you next week.
Join us for our next cup of coffee as we continue to have conversations in education that matter to you. I'm Dr. Rod Berger, and this is Coffeed.